And so for today's program, Nick Reich will do the introduction for us. Nick, come on up.
Thanks, Ramona. America's higher ed system is in dire need of some major overhaul. Skyrocketing costs and an increasing gap between higher income and white student completion rates versus their lower income and minority counterparts are driving a lack of economic mobility. Jamie Marisotis has served as the president and CEO of the Lumina Foundation since 2008. As an internationally recognized leader in philanthropy, education, and public policy, Jamie is tasked with leading the largest private foundation solely focused on increasing American success in higher education. Lumina's Goal 2025 is committed to increasing the number of Americans with high-quality degrees, certificates, and credentials. This big, hairy, audacious goal drives everything Lumina does as a thought leader, convener, grant maker, and investor in strategies that will design and build an equitable, accessible, and accountable higher ed system. Jamie previously served as co-founder and president of the Nonpartisan Institute for Higher Education Policy and as executive director of the Bipartisan National Commission on College Affordability, appointed by the president and congressional leaders. Jamie also is an author of the widely acclaimed book, America Needs Talent, which all of you received today courtesy of the Lumina Foundation. It was also named a top 10 business book of 2016 by Booklist. Over the past few years, I've been fortunate enough to do some work with Lumina and got to see firsthand that Jamie and the Lumina Foundation are not only entrepreneurial and innovative leaders across higher education, but are leading examples of how philanthropy should be delivered. Jamie Marisotis.
Well, thank you, Nick. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm really happy to be here, and I want to begin by saying that I'm delighted to be back at Rotary. I was here a few years ago and talked a little bit about Goal 2025. It is my persistent theme in life, and you're going to hear about it again today, but I'm going to talk a little more broadly about some other issues related to America's future. You know, I think with each passing year since I relocated to Indianapolis almost a decade ago with my family, I've really felt a deeper connection to this city and its leaders from my previous post in Washington, D.C. So, you know, I really want to begin by saying it's really good to be back. And speaking of back, okay, so I recognize that I'm dating myself a little bit here, but I imagine a number of you in the room know this movie. My kids know that it is my personal favorite, and I quote the darn thing all the time. Now, many of you may remember this scene. You remember the scene here, right, where he says, "Marty, I have to tell you about the future." Well, I'm also here to tell you about the future. I'm here to tell you about a topic with huge implications for the future. Yours, mine, Indiana's, the country. And in a word, that topic is talent. You know, talent is and really has always been, I think, the key to economic and social success for individuals, for communities, for regions, for every state, really for our nation as a whole. Without talent that's fully and thoughtfully developed, steadily upgraded, and in constant supply, I think the bright future that we all yearn for simply won't happen. So, since the last time I was here, Nick mentioned that I've released a book that gets to the very heart of our country's path to the future, America Needs Talent. The book actually draws on some of those three decades of experience that Nick mentioned that make up my life where the confluence of higher education, public policy, and philanthropy actually get together. And today I want to explore some of the ideas in the book that I hope all of us will consider, beginning with the one that I just mentioned, one that I think everyone here can agree to, the idea that talent really is the key to our future success as a nation and as individuals. Before I get too deep into the book, though, I want to take a minute to think about the future. Being home to the late, great Kurt Vonnegut, Indianapolis is the perfect place really for all of us to dream about the future, right? So the man wrote some of the most intriguing and some people might say some of the most frightening accounts of what the future holds for mankind. But, you know, even in his signature pessimism, Vonnegut seemed to be nudging us, suggesting that a little reflection and self-awareness could go a long way to save us from ourselves. Now, about a dozen years ago, Kurt Vonnegut gave one of his last interviews and summed up his challenge to all of us in a passing remark to the to Marketplace commentator David Brancaccio. He said, "I'll tell you, one thing that no cabinet has ever had is a secretary of the future, and there are no plans at all for my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren." Thank goodness for public broadcasting, right? So, I mean, this is a hugely powerful question. Brancaccio knew it, and if you actually follow him, you'll know that he keeps coming back to that single line that Kurt Vonnegut used, producing some terrific radio essays on that very question. Do we need a secretary of the future? What would he or she do? Who's looking ahead and making sure that our grandchildren actually inherit the world that they deserve? Now, David Brancaccio was actually in town a few months back, hosted by our friends and partners at WFYI and the team at the Vonnegut Memorial Library. And listening to him reflect on the economic, environmental, and social trajectory that we're on, I was really struck again by this Secretary of the Future idea all over. You see, at Lumina Foundation, we think about the future a great deal. Brancaccio even used a benchmark when he was talking about the Secretary of the Future idea, because it happens to be our favorite year at Lumina Foundation, 2025. For those of you who were here last time when I talked, you'll recognize Lumina's goal. We want, by 2025, 60% of all Americans to hold high-quality post-secondary degree, certificate, or other credential. And you'll notice something else about that goal, which is that time has this really annoying habit of racing by. So now suddenly, 2025 is a lot closer than it was before. So I'll talk a little bit more about why this goal is so important for the country, how it's going to drive the talent that we need for our future. But first, as in any conversation about our future, I want to take just a minute to talk about the past. In many ways, you know, I think the 20th century defined who we are as a nation for ourselves and the world. Now, take as an example this picture right here of pre-World War II America. This is circa 1939. Now, take a close look at that guy sitting on the roof. You see him there with the mandolin in his hands. If you focus on his face, you may notice it looks a little bit like mine. Well, that's because that guy on the roof there is actually my dad. Now, my dad was actually the same age as Kurt Vonnegut, born in 1922. So in this picture, he's 17 years old. And as you can see, he was already a working man. My dad's parents immigrated to New Hampshire from Greece just a few years before he was born. And by the time of this photo, he had actually dropped out of high school to support his family. Because, and we all know the story, right? His father wasn't able to find work during the Depression. So my dad used his great skill as a guitar and a mandolin player, which he developed beginning when he was actually 7 years old, to help the family survive. And I think we know in those days, it literally meant survive. Now, a few years after this picture was taken, he was drafted. He was shot down in the European theater and was a POW, returning home in 1945 to eventually settle into a working class career. My parents, my brothers and I and my grandmother all lived in a two-bedroom house in a blue-collar community outside of Hartford, Connecticut. You know, my parents never made it to college, and the truth is, as a family, we never fully made it to the middle class. But with the combined effort of both parents, my dad as a salesman, my dad could sell you something he already owned, and my mother as a secretary for the local police department, we were okay, we got by. But my mother and father were driven by the idea that all of their children, four sons, had to go to college. And they saved every penny that they had to make that possible. And though, you know, the truth is it wasn't nearly enough, I like to call myself a walking advertisement for every church, government, and college financial aid program you've ever heard of. My brothers and I all made it through, doing reasonably well, and hopefully doing some good along the way. The point is, we succeeded the way that millions of Americans succeeded. We were the products of an era that was known for a can-do American spirit. And if you want proof of that, just look at what we accomplished as a nation in the 20th century. You know, during that period, which a Life magazine publisher, Henry Luce, famously called the American Century, we were driven by a unifying belief in the very idea of America, where hard work and self-determination reaped rich rewards. It was the American Century because we believed, because we had the American people, and they had the talent that made us the world's leader in just about everything. You know, think about what we accomplished in that century. We cured polio, we reached the moon, we won the Cold War. We even created the internet. How did we do it? Well, we did it with talent. But you know, I think it's worth considering here early in the 21st century, do we still have what it takes? Do we still believe? Can we actually muster the talent to do it all over again? Well, I certainly believe that we can, but we can't do it the same way we did it back then. The point is, God-given talent like my dad's is simply not sufficient in the 20th century, 21st century, or in the future that's before us. The landscape has just changed too dramatically, and that dramatic change is only going to continue. Global competition has soared, so there are now some 2 million jobs unfilled in the American economy right now because of a lack of qualified candidates. 3/4 of CEOs say that finding qualified people is now their top concern as an employer. And 2/3 of all the jobs being created today require some form of post-high school education or training. So in short, I think the recipe for 21st century success is far more complex, and the need for talent, all kinds of talent, is greater than ever before. Now, I should probably pause here for a second because I realize that I've used the word talent about a dozen times so far and I haven't actually told you what I mean by talent, and that's probably worth explaining. So this is what I say in the book. I say in the book that talent is what happens when knowledge, skills, and abilities are honed by things like education and experience in ways that not only impact the individual but ultimately all of us as a society. The point is that talent is much more than simply innate ability. It's not merely being able to throw a perfect 40-yard spiral or play an amazing sonata. It's about values and judgment. It's knowledge of particular domains and the human context that give it meaning. And just as our society has evolved, so too must our view of talent and our means for actually developing it. That means that thoughtful, deliberate choices have to be made by the private sector, by government, by education, by individuals, to grow talent in America. Now, in the book, I lay out these 5 ways that we can get to this more talented society and set ourselves on the path to that brighter, more secure future. Vonnegut was asking us to think ahead, way ahead, but also to think differently than the way we think now. And I think the 5 ways outlined here represent some of that new thinking, so let me just quickly delve into each for a brief moment. So let me begin with the first one that you saw on that list, which is private sector innovation. What do I really mean when I say we should unleash private sector innovation? Well, what I mean is that we need to give the private sector the tools that it actually needs to be more consciously focused on talent development and deployment. However, as everybody in this room knows, this doesn't mean just giving employers tools and walking away. It means civic organizations, public education, health and human service providers all need to help the private sector understand the social and the economic realities of their workers' lives. This public-private partnership can help ensure that everyone is focused on the real-world needs of citizens. Innovation only thrives once education and employment are really tightly intertwined. So here you'll see where Mr. Vonnegut really captured my imagination in the book. Because I talk about creating something called the U.S. Department of Talent. By the way, Photoshop's a wonderful thing. It doesn't actually exist. But just as Vonnegut, one of the masters of the cautionary tale, wasn't suggesting more government, I'm not either. What I'm suggesting is a Department of Talent, a Secretary of the Future, These kind of things are really about better government. Even if there were no actual department, how do we actually think differently about the federal government's role in this talent development and deployment process? How do we rethink the work of agencies like the U.S. Department of Education and the Labor Department and different entities within the federal government like the Citizenship and Immigration Service and the Department of Homeland Security? Because right now, each of these entities plays a critical role in attracting and retaining talent, but they're really not playing in concert. They're really not acting together. More intentional alignment would actually link efforts that have been long disconnected and bureaucratically entrenched. It would inspire and implement new approaches, one that focused squarely on outcomes. It would inspire truly futuristic thinking. It would send, I think, a powerful message to our citizens, to employers, and to global partners and competitors. It would show that as one partner in the equation of talent, the federal government is actually serious and strategic about its role in developing, harnessing, and deploying that talent. And even as we seek to redefine the federal role in talent development, I firmly believe that individual states and even regions or cities can serve as instructive models that can help actually develop and expand the change that we need nationwide. There's a good deal of evidence that states can effectively be used as talent laboratories, places where innovative ideas for growing talent can be incubated and tested. And when it comes to incubators for future innovations, no entity, I think, tops the tremendous potential of our nation's cities and metro areas. I believe we need to see cities and regions not as challenges to be solved, but as hubs of talent, places where innovation and creativity thrive. Now, communities that are succeeding in this talent hub concept are finding that cultivating the talent that's already there, not just attracting and retaining talent from the outside, is the most successful strategy. Now, certainly attracting talent is important, and it's a viable approach for economic development. We've seen that happen all over the country, one that many cities have successfully used for decades. But frankly, without a holistic approach, talent recruitment can actually have a downside. It can increase social inequity. Because what happens is, as the creative and the entrepreneurial classes move in, the local residents, who are often low-income and minority populations, they can be left behind in that urban renaissance that we all seek. We've seen that example, by the way, happen in cities across the country, Austin, Denver, and many other places, which have prospered as cities, but seen the capacities of their homegrown talent actually decline because it's the outsiders that are driving the success, reaping the benefits of that success, and the locals really aren't benefiting. So those metropolitan areas that succeed as talent hubs are the ones that confront these equity and these demographic issues. Yes, they attract talent. There's nothing wrong with that. But they also work hard to develop and keep their homegrown talent. They make sure that various sectors and leaders work together, deliberately, collaboratively, and harmoniously. They set goals and work hard to attain them. They listen to what employers actually need. They foster a sense of place, and they offer multiple pathways to success for all types of people. Indianapolis, I think, is doing really good work in this sphere, building a world-class food scene, doing things like rebuilding a public transportation sector and reviving green spaces like the Glick Peace Walk that many of you probably crossed when you got here today. This corridor is connecting neighborhoods that were once isolated from one another. And, you know, that disconnection did nothing to cultivate the sense of community or equitable access to city resources on which we all know that Indianapolis prides itself today. So kudos to all of you for supporting these efforts to connect and retain residents. But, you know, I think the next step is making sure that those same residents understand and can actually access high-quality education and training after high school, leading them on the pathway to the next learning opportunity, the next job, the next great life. When a city communicates to its workforce that, you know, quote, you matter, you're safe, and you can grow here, you know, that city truly reaps the benefits. This leads me to the next way to boost the nation's talent quotient, which is to really, I think, now and for the future, redesign the educational system so that it actually serves the people of today, today's students, the ones that have to succeed in today's and tomorrow's world. Now, remember, I told you that we'd be talking a little more about that 2025 goal. And here's the point why I think it really matters. Because for all of its good points, the problem with today's higher education system is that it simply can't produce enough of the talent that we need going forward. Far from it. And I think you know the reasons why. Today's system is unaffordable for far too many of our fellow Americans, especially those who are non-white or first generation, those who attend part-time, those who work, people who have children. The system doesn't produce enough graduates. I think I made that point a little bit earlier. And it doesn't always give those graduates, frankly, the knowledge, skills, and abilities, the talent that they need to ensure their long-term career success. So to address these problems, to close those attainment gaps and actually maximize talent development, we have to redesign the system so that it meets the needs of today's students and of society as a whole. We need a system that is affordable, that is student-centered, and one that's relentlessly focused on genuine learning. That type of system is an absolute necessity if we're ever going to be able to produce the human capital, the talent, that we need here in the 21st century. You know, there are no quick fixes or magic bullets when it comes to building the type of system that can deliver equity and excellence, that redesigned system that this nation needs. But there are things that can ensure and should be done. We need to design a system that's student-centered, focus on what students actually learn and can do, not on how college has always worked. We need to make sure that there are pathways to credentials, ones that are meaningful in the job market, that are clear, and that lead to lifelong learning and to more opportunity. And we have to give students support along the way so that once they get into school, they actually stay on those pathways and complete their credentials. You know, if we can do that, I think we'll go a long way towards making our higher education system the engine for talent development that America truly needs. And now, let me take you back to the future again. Just as Kurt Vonnegut did, I think we can all imagine a nation that's very different from the one that we have today if we do some of the things that I just mentioned. Because what we can imagine is really a second American century, where we can be a much more equitable society, one where employers fully recognize and realize the value of that more diverse talent pool, and where policymakers use education strategies and social innovation efforts to broaden opportunity and boost success for all Americans. In this second American century, national prosperity would no longer be defined merely by the size of our economy, but by an increasingly innovative private sector driven to meet America's needs, its social needs, and its economic needs. It's possible that in the second American century, we can develop the talent that we need to actually be prosperous as a country. But you know, I think the path to get us there is really quite different from the one that we followed in the 20th century. We have to, just as David Brancaccio and Kurt Vonnegut have pressed us to do, think of our grandchildren, of their future, of the entirely different mindset that it will require to reinvent the world and make it a little easier for more Americans to feel the stability and see the opportunity that would allow them to channel what I think one of Vonnegut's best characters, Uncle Alex, and look around and say, you know, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is. So, you know, when my father back in the 20th century was in his late teens and America was a different place, the future really was wide open but without barriers. Still, my dad and my mother worked very hard and, you know, they made their own way and they created opportunity for themselves and for their children. And, you know, today, thanks in large part to their insistence on education, those children, these four really good-looking guys here, they're all successful adults. But I think the point is our path to success wasn't the same one that our parents took. And, you know, that path, the path that my kids will need to take in the future, along with all of your own children and grandchildren, that path will have to be profoundly different from the one that I took and my brothers took. So, my friends, now is the time to start clearing that new path. to ourselves act as secretaries of the future for our children and usher in yet another American century, one that really belongs to them. So thank you all for what you're doing to contributing to an Indianapolis future. I think my Lumina colleagues and I are clear in saying that we couldn't be prouder to be here, to be your partners, proud to call this city our home, and we very much look forward to seeing that future standing by all of your sides. Thank you all very much.